let me in.
Shiba chiba,
I wanna be closer to you.
Shiba chiba,
open up your soul.
Shiba chiba,
let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. One of the things that San Franciscans enjoy almost more than eating is going to film festivals. And so we are very fortunate that there are so many amazing film festivals that happen in this town. One of them is the Frameline Festival, and it's Frameline 48. And here to talk about it is the executive director, Allegra Madsen. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show. Now, I know that there are people who are new to the area and don't know what the Frameline Festival is. So can you give our listening audience like an overview of it?
Absolutely. The Frameline Film Festival is the largest and longest running queer film festival in the world. Every year we run towards the end of June. This year our dates are June 16th through 19th, and we bring 11 days of the best queer film from around the world right here to San Francisco.
And how do you find all of this amazing film?
My job is to go out and scour the world and go to different film festivals all over the place.
Oh, cool.
And try to track down the best movies I can.
So you're saying you're going to different film festivals, so are other how do the people who are doing the films get into the film festivals if you're going to film festivals?
We have two pipelines.
Okay.
So I go out and I go to other film festivals in Berlin or Cannes or whatever to get some of the top lines. And then we also have a submission portal, so people send us our films. Send us their films, and I watch those too.
So how many movies would you say you personally see in a year while you're preparing for the festival?
Ooh, I'd say it's a good 500.
Yowza! I admire that.
In a lot of ways it's a dream job, but then it's also a little bit crazy.
I would imagine it, and then you whittle it down to how many for a film festival?
This year we have around 115 titles, and we have about 90 programs.
Wow. Okay. So is there a theme for each of the frame lines, or is it just sort of gay film, enjoy?
Well, when you see that many, you start to see common threads that connect sort of what's on filmmakers' minds at the time.
Okay.
And this year our festival theme is intersections. And that's partially because we are out at a bunch of different venues in San Francisco, and we're kicking off the festival on Juneteenth, June 19th, and we're closing down Castro Street. We're having a block party, and we're going to screen the Long Live Montero, the Lil Nas X documentary.
Wow! So you're closing down the Castro, but isn't the Castro Theater closed?
Yes, the Castro Theater the Castro Theater itself is closed for renovations, but that's why we're going to close down the street in front of it. And actually, we're really excited. We just got confirmation from another planet that we will be relighting the Castro Theater neon blade out front on June 19th during the celebration.
Oh, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're really excited.
Excellent, excellent. So how are you kicking up? So you're having this great big block party, but what's the film that really kicks it off?
Well, then we are going to be at the Palace of Fine Art.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say a must-see is Young Heart. It's a beautiful film about coming of age and coming into who you love without any trauma.
Oh, that's like... that's usually when you see film there, that has a gay theme, there does seem to be an element of trauma in it.
Does seem to be an element of trauma. That's why I was so excited to see this one and really celebrate it. This is what it would look like if you know, young love is given the reverence, given the room to like bloom as it should.
That's excellent.
You know, first love always comes with a little bit of trauma, but
yeah. But if you don't have any other things weighing in on it, then it can just be about the normal trauma. So
exactly.
All right. So that kicks it off. So for the people who don't necessarily know, I know you have something called like boys shorts and girl shorts.
We do have shorts programs. This year we have. They are not identity based. They're all curated shorts programs. And we have like documentary shorts. We celebrate our homegrown filmmakers mm-hmm. with homegrown shorts. We have like a romance package. And this year we also have Black queer stories from across time and space shorts package.
Very cool. So let's talk about some of the homegrown artists that are going to be featured in the Frameline Festival. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the things we'll be seeing?
Certainly. So our homegrown film program is it's a shorts package, and we have an amazing documentary about Mother Bar, which is right on 16th and Mission, and we're going to show that in our queer spaces program, and we're going to show that at the newly christened Stud Bar. Mm. We have an amazing doc from a local team about an artist in Chicago that does portraits of women mid-screen, mm-hmm. sort of this feminist whale.
Oh, cool.
And then we also have a full feature-length documentary called Sally about Sally Gearhart that's going to screen at the KQED screening room. Sally Gearhart was a San Francisco-based activist that fought right alongside Harvey Milk against Anita Bryant and the bigoted laws trying to keep queer people from teaching in public schools.
Very cool. Very cool indeed. And I'm looking at your website, and of course, because I'm a kind of a horror fan,
oh, yeah.
I see something called Carnage for Christmas. And so you had me at Carnage, but tell our listening audience about that one.
We do have our Frameline Fangs track. So Carnage for Christmas is one of three, or actually four this year, four horror films that we're showcasing.
Mm-hmm.
Carnage for Christmas is a really interesting film. It's by a young, and when I say young, I mean she's like 23, 24,
mm-hmm.
A young trans filmmaker from Australia, and this, I believe, is her third or fourth feature film,
mm-hmm.
And it is about a trans podcaster, true crime podcaster, that goes back to their hometown to solve some grisly murders from their teenage years.
Wow. And I am also seeing that you are having what you've described as a bisexual XXX film noir called Don't Change Minds. I love the title. So just tell our listening audience about that one.
So that is a retro film. Time when queer film was kind of relegated to the adult category, and that was really the only place you saw queer people on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But folks really took the artistry and went to the next level. So this is an adult themed noir kind of cult adult film classic. It's sort of like, what if Cagney and Lacey were in love with each other?
Mm. I thought they were, but no, that's just me.
I mean, what if they admitted it?
Got it. So within this huge number, this, you know, 150 you said, like, is there one that really that you're hoping that it may be like slightly underrated, but you're hoping that people come and see it?
I love all the films. I'm gonna say Any Other Way, the Jackie Shane documentary.
Mm.
This is a really interesting doc about we would call her now a trans woman. Mm-hmm. At the time, mm-hmm. I don't think they had the language, but she was a singer and she was rising in her like soul singing career. And they thought that she presented too feminine, and she, rather than change anything about herself, she just walked away from fame and in the spotlight and went and lived her life as she wanted.
And my listeners know how much I love Jackie Shane. Ever since a listener introduced Jackie Shane to me decades ago, and I was just,
oh, that's so amazing.
Yeah, it was with Walking the Dog, because that's like the video that they have, and I was like, this is amazing. And so, you know, so I'm very excited. I'll be having those on, the director for that documentary, on right after you. So it's good that,
no way.
Yes,
that's awesome.
So it's going to be great. Now, here's a title. And, you know, I'm very much drawn by titles. It's called Scarecrow in a Garden of Cucumbers. I want to know what that's about.
That is a film starring Holly Woodlawn, who was a member. It's also a retro program. Who was a member of Andy Warhol's factory and sort of ran in those circles. She was also a trans actress, and she is a phenomenal comedic actress. Like, I'm like, what if Amy Sedaris was a trans woman in the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of a country mouse meets the city, ridiculous romp through New York.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, so this is the Frameline's 48th year. Is that true?
It is our 48th festival. We've been around since 1977.
That's just crazy. I mean, one of the things I love about most of the festivals that I've heard about is it just starts with someone's, like a couple of kids, they have an idea. Let's do this. And they have no idea how much work it's going to be, which is why they do it. And then suddenly here we are, you know, 48
exactly.
years later.
That is exactly Frameline's story. We started in a storefront with a projector and an old bed sheet.
So you weren't part of the startup. No, I didn't think so, because you sound like you're like, you know, 15. So that was its iteration, the bed sheet. Do you know when they graduated from bed sheets to an actual venue?
It was within the first 5 years we went to the Roxy. So the Roxy was our first theater. And then we built, and then we really rooted ourselves at the Castro Theater. But, and both of those venues, since the mid 80s have been our stalwart venues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so for people who are now fascinated and want to go see the film festival, where can they get tickets? When does it start? And how do they do it all?
How do you do it all? It starts on June 19th. You can go to our website right now, frameline.org, to get tickets. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the website, we have interest collection. So if you like rom-coms or horror, you can find your track. But if you need any additional help sort of navigating your way through all of these films, definitely follow us on Instagram, because my programmers always are putting out pics.
Very cool. Very cool. So once again, for our listening audience, I know you're shutting down Castro on the 19th. What time should they get there to enjoy the party?
They should get there at around 7, and we will screen the Lil Nas X documentary when the sun goes down.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Very cool. Well, I want to thank you, Allegra Madsen, for being on the show today, and give our listening audience one more time the website where they can find out all of the movies that you're playing.
You can find us at frameline.org.
Excellent. Thanks once again, Allegra Madsen. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out the Frameline Festival. It's, you know, I've been and I've had a blast. It's fun and awesome, and you won't want to miss it.
Says she can't so walk the dog. Just a walk in the dog. If you don't know how to do it, we'll show you how to walk the dog. Ask a mother for 15 cents. See her in a jumping dress. the 4th of July. Just a walk in the dark. If you don't know how to do it, show you how to walk the dog. Mary May, Mike and Trey, tell me, baby, how does your God grow? You've got silver bells, cockle shells, little maids all in a row.
You lie, don't hurt me no more.
That's Jackie Shane. That's a double header from Jackie Shane. Don't play that song, You Lie. That is from all the singles plus the concert. And then Walking the Dog, which is one that I had gotten from YouTube many years ago. Like, I want to thank the listener who, like, 20-some-odd years ago turned me on to Jackie Shane, who was amazing. And other people seem to think so, too, because they made a whole documentary about Jackie Shane. Here to talk about Any Other Way, I'd like to welcome directors Michael Mabbitt and Luca Rosenberg Lee. Hello.
Hey, Melon.
So first I want to find out about how did you two come together to work on this film, and how did you two hear about Jackie Shane? Go.
Yeah, well, I actually first heard about Jackie from Michael. This was like a few years ago. We started working on this project for me and him at least 3 years ago. And he said, have you ever heard of Jackie Shane? And I said no, which I was surprised about because, you know, I'm a black trans person myself. I thought I knew a lot about black trans history, but I didn't know about Jackie. So that's how I was introduced to Jackie and how we ended up connecting on this film. And Michael had seen one of my previous films called Passing about my own black trans experience. Mm-hmm. And he liked the style that I made it in, and it brought us together.
That's excellent. So then, Michael, how did you first learn about Jackie Shane?
Well, I'm a Toronto filmmaker, and I learned about Jackie about 12 years ago when I stumbled upon her album, Jackie Shane Live. I'm just reeling that you had the great fortune to hear her 20 years ago. It fills me with so much joy. You have 8 years more of Jackie in your heart and soul than I do. That's amazing. But I heard that album, and I'd never heard of it before. I'd never heard of her before. Mm-hmm. And this was recorded in my hometown, you know, where we know Joni Mitchell and Gordon Lightfoot and mm-hmm. all of this, you know, the kind of folky thing and then the rock thing and now the hip hop thing. But I didn't know this music was made in my town, and that just blew my mind. And I wanted to know more about her. And at the time there was nothing. There was only rumors. Mm-hmm. She disappeared in 1971, walked mm-hmm. off at the height of her career. And that's all we knew. So I wanted to know more because this music was gorgeous. The message was amazing. It spoke to me. But I also wanted to know why in the world this person who was a bona fide star here, why their history had all but erased, mm-hmm. you know? So that began kind of a many, many year search for Jackie, and I finally found her in 2016 when her album or all her music was reissued. Mm-hmm. And in fact, nominated for a Grammy, this reissue. And it wasn't until then, 45 years later, that we all found out that Jackie was, in fact, alive and well and living as a recluse in Nashville. So, and that began an even longer journey with Jackie and I in this film. So, yeah, it was incredible.
So, yeah, because when I first was introduced to Jackie Shane, I went down this rabbit hole, and they were like, oh, nobody knows where Jackie Shane is, and da-da-da-da-da. And so I'm thrilled that you found this person. So what was it like to finally meet Jackie Shane?
Well, I never met her in person, and very few people did. And so this was all, our relationship was all over the phone.
Oh, okay.
And we would speak once a week at least, and we spoke for well over a year. And with the intention of saying, let's make this film together. Mm-hmm. And when she finally agreed to it, it was one of the happiest days of my life. And then she passed away shortly thereafter, which was certainly one of the saddest days of my life and mm-hmm. saddest times of my life. But speaking with her for that year, and she just talked and talked. She had so much to say. It was just flowing out of her. And the conversations were on average about 5 hours. And she talked to me for 11 hours straight once.
Wow.
It was just incredible, like the wisdom and the history and the life that she led and the inspiration. Like it was just, she was such a remarkable person, and spending that year with her was the greatest honor of my life. It was incredible. And of course, the plan was to make this this film with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I cried buckets of tears when she passed away. In retrospect, in hindsight, I guess, because she passed away and we then had to use these audio recordings of this phone call, of these phone calls with her,
mm-hmm.
that actually kind of opened up the film to, you know, that's why Luca and I were able to collaborate, because Jackie was no longer here. We worked with two incredible Black trans actors to perform as Jackie, as her younger self, and then in the conversations with me, and brought Jackie's voice, her true voice, to life with rotoscope animation, and then those performers are in the film. It created a situation where our team of filmmakers became kind of much bigger, and it created a really unique opportunity, and I think a unique film because of that.
Definitely.
Okay, so you've made this film about Jackie Shane, covering the entire life. What were some of the things that she revealed to you about them that were maybe harrowing or inspiring, or maybe just sort of gave you hope for humanity?
I guess for me, what gave me hope was, what gives me hope and inspiration every day is there's so much laughter in the conversations with Jackie.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, the hardships she went through, the evil people that she met, it was extraordinary. And Jackie's take on these people were, you know, she laughed at them. She thought that the evil and the hatred that came out of these people was based in fear, and the fear of being true to themselves. And so Jackie was true to themselves, and these people weren't. And she almost felt sorry for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But moreover, she led with joy. She led with this music. She led with her humor. She led with her getting on stage and having the courage to tell her personal story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that inspiration, you know, don't be scared. It's a scary world out there, and you know, be yourself and you will be happy and you will be free. And mm-hmm. I think that was the kind of the biggest thing. And she, when she was performing in Toronto, the people that were drawn to her were from all walks of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just saw this person on stage being true to themselves, and they said, she can do it, I can do it, you know? And the courage it took for her to do that, and the obstacles, were, you know, it was huge, but it sent such a positive message out into the world and helped so many people. And so I hope this film does the same, and certainly my relationship with her, you know, inspires me every day, her message.
Okay, and how about you,
yeah,
Luca?
I completely agree on that. I think, you know, her confidence and just her ability to say, you know, this is who I am,
mm-hmm.
is very, very inspiring and very hopeful, especially in the times that we're in right now. And, you know, I know a lot of trans people, including myself, some days who really struggle to, you know, put themselves in any kind of spotlight or to go after any kind of dreams because of what people might say. And the
mm-hmm.
fact that she was doing this at a time when there was way less education and way less information and, you know, hate in it that was still there, even though there's hate now, but it was in a different place then as well. And I mean, so to hear so much joy and so much laughter and so much of, you know, this is who I am and I'm not going to let you take that away from me is inspiring.
Was there any story that, that Jackie told that, was particularly like tickled you particularly, both as a director, but also as a Black trans person?
That's a great question. You know, I love that I thought it was really interesting that she didn't drink. She talked a lot about that and how, you know, for the music industry and just her thoughts on drugs and things like that. But I liked her stories of all of the guys at the club and the mobsters who would flirt with her, you know, and just that whole dynamic that she had. And I think one of the reasons that she didn't drink, there was a few, but one of them was, you know, she had to keep a, she had to keep her in her right mind. You know, she had to be aware because you never know when, you know, you're gender nonconforming, you know, things happen, you got to be ready.
Right.
But I just liked her perspective on the fact that, yeah, you know, people liked her. She knew people found her attractive. And I just thought those stories were great.
Excellent. How about Michael? Was there a particular story that just really tickled your funny bone?
There's a few things that we couldn't work into the film. Hearing Jackie laugh at any time was so, it's just the most beautiful sound in the world. But she was, I think she was playing in Boston, and she looked out into the audience, and there was a chimpanzee in a full suit in the audience.
Okay.
And she said she had to blink and make sure she was seeing what she thought she saw. She eventually met the chimpanzee's owner, and he was a gentleman by the name of Carfair, who was an infamous pickpocket, and he was so infamous that he could no longer pick pockets himself. So he got this monkey, and everybody, he'd take the monkey to the bar, and everybody would be so amazed by this monkey and distracted, all the while the monkey would be clearing them out and taking their watches.
Wow.
Just hearing her tell that story. yeah, and I think she said something like, you know, I've met a few gorillas in my time, but I've never met a monkey. And, you know, there's many, many stories like that. And her life was, you know, she knew Little Richard. She opened for Etta James. She, like, it was the just the stories, the rich, rich stories of a really professional, hardworking musician were wildly entertaining and just so good. And at the time in her life, looking back on this for her, it was like a joy for her to pass these stories on. So, you know, didn't necessarily change my life, but oh my God, it made me laugh.
Sure. Now, I heard, like, I read somewhere that she and Little Richard were cousins. Is that just something that someone made up, or is that true?
I think that's apocryphal. I think that's something that was made up. But they met when they were, when she was really young. He had just, I think, had his hit with Tutti Frutti, and they met. She was in her teens in Nashville, and they became fast friends, friends. And that friendship lasted into once she left the stage and was still in, she went to Los Angeles to be with her mom, and she was still with Little Richard. And so, no, they weren't related. But she also says that maybe she was a drummer originally, I'm sure you know, and a really well-regarded drummer. And maybe some of Little Richard's songs started having some of Jackie's drum patterns in them. And so
got it.
So they weren't cousins, but they were close. And I think they admired one another greatly. And I think she also, you know, she told us so much that kind of dictated what the kind of how to approach film, how to approach art. And she thought Little Richard was a little noisy. So she was much more demure, and I think kind of said, I'm going to let my talent speak for myself, not my outrageousness. So she learned a lot, both how to walk the walk and how not to strut the strut from Richard.
Although in like her any other way, she's talking about grabbing her chicken by the hand, and that was just like, ooh, spicy.
Yeah, she wasn't totally subtle, but I think it was more off stage, and I think she was a very private person.
Got it.
On stage and gave everything there. I don't think it was a caricature at all, but I think it was more Little Richard off stage that she got a bit of a giggle out.
Gotcha. Now she walked away, and then she was off the radar. How did you end up finding her?
Well, I, you know, kind of like you, I would, you know, tried to find out some information, and there was just nothing. And then when it was announced that there was this reissue in 2016 from Numero.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to be that the gentleman writing the liner notes was a musical anthropologist from Toronto named Rob Bowman, who I had worked with on my first film, and is just, he's a Grammy Award winning, just an incredible academic and writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him up to kind of say, I wonder who knew Jackie in Toronto. And she still hadn't, we knew she was alive, but she hadn't kind of resurfaced publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob said, I've been talking to her for these liner notes. And so, and at the time she wanted a film, a documentary made about herself, and was kind of contemplating a few different filmmakers. And Rob was one of her gatekeepers. And then there was another gentleman in London who was another gatekeeper. And so I kind of made my case to these people of why I wanted to make this film and why I loved her and what she meant to me and to the city. And over the course of a year, they would pass these things on. And after about a year, she finally agreed to talk with me. And so that began the year-long relationship with Jackie. But it was, and she was really methodical about mm-hmm. this. Her privacy and her image was something that she held dear and held close to her chest. And so it was a long, slow, and very methodical and thoughtful process from her part before she, even let me in to see what kind of person I was and what kind of film I wanted to make and mm-hmm. if I was listening to her and understanding her. It was a very, very, very thoughtful and frankly grueling process for me.
Right. Well, I have so many more questions for you, but we are almost out of time. So I just want our listening audience to know that the film Any Other Way is going to be at the Palace of Fine Arts on June 23rd at 6:00. And has it shown anywhere else or?
We premiered at South by Southwest and
yep.
And at Hot Docs, and it won awards at Hot Docs. And we are going to Sheffield, England, and it's been in Vancouver. But we are so, so excited to be coming to San Fran for this.
Excellent.
Definitely.
So you'll be there and you can experience all the love that people have for Jackie Shane.
Yes.
Can't wait.
We're looking forward.
All right. Well, Michael, Luca, I want to thank you both so much, not just for being on the show, but for tracking Jackie Shane down, making this documentary so that I can learn more about Jackie Shane because I'm a huge fan. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And there's an unreleased song in the film that we found in her archive. So have a listen to that.
All right. Thank you so much.
People
of Earth, this is your opportunity. Go check out Jackie Shane. You've heard me play Jackie Shane. Now you get to hear Jackie Shane in her words and in the director's words. So I'll be back in just a moment. Jackie Shane, Stand Up Straight and Tall, from all the singles plus the concert, and there's also a box set called Any Other Way. And the documentary will be here on June 23rd at 6 o'clock. So, you know, it's the Jackie Shanapalooza. But we are going to shift gears now because there is a world premiere of a brand new show called Seeing Stars. Here to talk about it, the star or the person who's seeing stars themselves, I'd like to welcome Steve Budd. Hello.
Hi, Marilyn. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. So first of all, tell me a little bit about you. How long have you been doing one-person shows?
Wow. Well, I've been an actor for about 30 years, and one-person show-wise, I've been doing a solo performance, I guess, since about 2006. But my first full-length show was 8 years ago, 2016, when I did What They Said About Love at the San Francisco Fringe, which ended up bringing to the Marsh in 2018.
Now, when you do a one-person show, I mean, because it's all you, you're going to sink or swim. Did you find, when you first started doing it, did you find it harrowing or did you find it exhilarating?
Both. I think harrowing first. I was like super scared, you know, very, very nervous, more stage fright than usual when I went out. When I was about to go on stage for the first time performing a full-length solo show. But then, you know, the exhilaration kicked in. So that's what's kept me at it.
So when the one-person shows that I've seen by and large have been, you know, semi-autobiographical or completely autobiographical, so you've done a number of one-person shows. So are these autobiographical or are they flights of fancy?
They're autobiographical, yes. But the first two pieces I did, my first two shows, What They Said About Love and What They Said About Sex, were created also from interviews. So I play multiple characters, people who I interviewed, you know, characters based on the people I interviewed, using their words. So using other people's stories and then weaving in my own.
Okay.
So this show is, I just created from a true story, a family story, talking, you know, about me with a big focus on my dad and my relationship with my dad.
Okay, well, so why is it called Seeing Stars? Was your dad a star, or are you talking about him like a star in the firmament or like a star on the screen?
Those are great guesses. It's called Seeing Stars, I mean, for a number of reasons. I don't want to totally give it away.
Okay.
But one reason is that I wanted to be a star myself of stage and screen.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And then there's something my dad went through where he felt like he was seeing stars. And then also I had a job at the time. These are events that took place about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's the story that I'm telling. I had a job teaching kids about the night sky. So I was taking a portable planetarium around to schools and introducing kids to the stars in the sky.
Ooh. And how old were these kids that you were introducing them to?
Mostly elementary school kids.
Okay. Because I remember like going to the planetarium as a kid and, you know, just being fascinated by it. But, you know, it was back when they had those really comfortable seats and I would fall asleep. But
sure. Yeah.
So talk about the process of writing this show of Seeing Stars. And are you playing one character or are you playing a sequence of characters? How is it working?
Well, I play myself, my dad, and my mom. And then I play a number of minor characters as well. So multiple characters.
Okay.
Basically, you know, there was this true event that happened, like I said, about 30 years ago. And I just felt like it was a great story that I wanted to dramatize. And initially, I was telling the story in like a 10-minute. This was over 10 years ago, I think. I'm telling the story in a kind of at various venues in the Bay Area for storytelling as a 10-minute version of what happened. I remember doing it at the Mill Valley Public Library, 10 or 15 minutes. And then I thought, oh, maybe it would make a movie. It could be a great movie. So I started writing it as a screenplay about, I don't know, 4 years ago, 3 or 4.
Okay.
Worked on it pretty hard in that way. And then I just wanted to get the story out there and bring it to the stage. And I thought, you know, the solo show format would work well for it. So then I reworked the script into a solo show, which maybe took a year.
Oh, okay.
And, that's kind of the process.
So you're originally going for a screenplay. So so I'm guessing that you've worked in both mediums. So how does it differ to write a script for a screenplay versus doing it on a stage?
That's pretty different. I mean, one, of course, one actor in a solo show, so I'm saying all the lines and a combination of narration and scenes, playing out scenes of dialogue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a screenplay is basically all dialogue. So you don't have the narration that I do in the one-man show. I guess in a movie could be voiceover, mm-hmm. but mostly you want to steer away from voiceover in a movie or keep it, you know, pretty minimal. And if, then you have multiple locations, which would be actually on site for a screenplay. So you're detailing all that and telling the time of day and all that. And then these are things I would just convey in the solo show, you know, theatrically, either just through mention and description or somehow through the lighting change, mm-hmm. Bringing a different location to life.
Okay, so did you talk about this story that you've told all over the place? Did your family ever get to see you tell this or hear you tell this story as part of a performance piece when you've done it in the last 30 years?
I've been told it was really the last 10 years that I did it as a performance piece, doing it as a story.
Okay,
my sister is the one family member. I have a brother, and I used to have parents. My parents have passed away, mm-hmm. but. My sister has seen it. She saw it as a story, and she saw another version of me performing it on, you know, the full-length solo show. And, she enjoyed it.
Now, to have a sibling hear the story, did she have a different, because did she experience the same thing, or did she have a different take on what happened?
Pretty similar, except our circumstances were a bit different. One, I was living at home. I had moved back in with my parents at the age of 31, which is also part of what this story is about. Before this whole thing happened with my dad, that the story revolves around, I had moved back in with my parents, and whereas my sister was, you know, away from home, actually getting her PhD in clinical psych, which was kind of fitting. But overall, so she didn't see as much of what happened as I did, but from what she knew of what happened, she was pretty much in agreement with my rendition.
Okay. And I know you don't want to give much away, but I'm reading between the lines that there was. I'm reading between the lines, and I think, okay.
Probably some of your audiences too.
Yeah, like we all have parents, and you know, some of them have.
I mean, that's part of what the story gets into too. Is like dealing with parents, but also dealing with aging parents,
mm-hmm.
Which is something a lot of people go through. And, of course, family dysfunction and mental health issues, all that stuff, issues, themes that a lot of people grapple with.
So when you do this and you're playing your dad, do you sometimes feel like you have more insight and empathy than maybe you did at the time?
Yeah, I think so. I've been working on this material for a while, and playing my parents, and especially it's kind of poignant, especially now that they've passed away,
mm-hmm.
Kind of bringing them to life on stage, I think has helped me, yes, as you said, have kind of more empathy for both of them.
Okay. So when and where is the show playing?
The show is playing at the Marsh Theater on Alston Way in downtown Berkeley. And officially opened this past Saturday, the 8th, running on Saturdays at 5 o'clock now through July 13th, except no show on June 22nd. Other than that, every Saturday between now and July 13th at 5 o'clock. It's an hour-long show.
Okay, and that's the Marsh here or the Marsh in Berkeley?
The Marsh in Berkeley.
The Marsh in Berkeley. And that's easily accessible through the Berkeley Bar, because I've gone to see many things. Yeah. So after you're done with this, what's next on your agenda?
I want to find more opportunities to perform the show for a variety of audiences and organizations, but also I'm working on a new show. I'm taking my kind of existing show from several years ago, What They Said About Love,
mm-hmm.
and I'm modifying it, revising it to give it more of a Jewish slant, so it'll be called Oi, What They Said About Love, with more Jewish characters and Jewish, issues and material, and I'll be performing that for the first time at the San Francisco Fringe in August.
And what? And so give us a little synopsis about what they said about love. What they said about love.
Yeah. I interviewed, again, that's a show created from interviews. So I interviewed a bunch of couples to get their stories of like how they met and married and how they worked things out. So I tell their stories in various stages and then weave in my own pursuit of a particular romantic interest from the past, from about 10 years ago, I guess. And the Jewish part is just, you know, people grappling maybe with interfaith marriages or different levels of observance or religiosity between partners and how they kind of come to terms with that and work it out. And there's some, I'd say, Jewish humor woven in as well.
Very cool. So for our listening audience who is now fascinated by your story, how would they find out more about you or just stalk you on the down low?
You know, they can stalk me or they can find me. Of course, on the Marsh website would be the first place to go to find out about the show and a little bit about me. Mm-hmm. That's themarsh.org. Mm-hmm. Right there on the homepage, you'll see the shows playing now, including mine, Seeing Stars. And my website, you know, stevebudd.com. That's another good place.
And Steve Budd with two D's.
That's correct.
All right. So one more time for our listening audience, when and where, and where can they get tickets?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question, Marilyn. First of all, the show is at the Marsh in Berkeley on Alston Way, downtown Berkeley, right near the BART, 2120 Alston Way. And it's called the Marsh Arts Center. Mm-hmm. And there's a cabaret there. I mean, there's like a cafe, a bar, you know, so you can get drinks of any kind. And it's Saturday. The show is on Saturday. Now through July 13th at 5 o'clock, 5 p.m., you get tickets at the Marsh website, themarsh.org.
And if they can they also walk up and see the show?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah, they absolutely can. And I hope your audience will join us because I'm proud of the show. I love doing it, and audiences have been loving it. So I'd love to have a lot of your audience come out and see it.
All right. Well, Steve Budd, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Marilyn, for having me.
All right. People of Earth, The Marsh, you can go check out Seeing Stars. We all have parents. And one of the things I like to say is most people think their parents are crazy, but I have papers to prove it. So for our listening audience, go check out everything that you've heard today. If you're not going to see stuff, it's because you're choosing to. We came out of a big old pandemic where we weren't allowed to go anywhere or do anything. And now you can. And I know it's hard to sort of get out of that habit of staying at home. But, you know, you can stay at home in your coffin when you're dead. So while you are alive, go and experience life, okay? And speaking of experiencing life, I'm about to go experience life and turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. We'll be pleasuring your ear hole. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and tiddly-doo. My